KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. So it's warming up. Let's find out what's in store for the weather this weekend. On the phone, I've got Cedric Haynes with ABC4. Good morning, Cedric.
Good morning. Hopefully the morning is off to a great start. A little on the cool side out there to kick off our day. But don't worry, our friend Mr. Sunshine is going to be back, and our temperatures will soar once again. We're looking at those highs climbing well above average. We're going to go with highs climbing into the lower 70s here as we get towards the Park City area this afternoon. The Heber Valley, we're looking at temperatures that will be climbing into the upper 70s to near 80 degrees by the time we get towards later this afternoon. So quite warm out there across the area. As we go throughout tonight, we'll see our overnight lows dropping back down into the upper 40s here across the area. And then as we go throughout the day on your Saturday, we're looking at those highs climbing into the mid 60s for Park City, highs in the lower 70s in the Heber Valley. And that's because we're going to have a cold front coming in, so it's going to make us a little cooler. We'll see a few more clouds on the increase as we go throughout the day on Saturday, with just a very slight chance of a spotty shower. But the bigger story will be the more sharp cool down that's expected as we get into your Sunday. In fact, Sunday we'll see those skies clearing back out with that sunshine returning, and we'll see those overnight lows dropping back down into the mid 30s as we kick off the day on Sunday. But the change will be the high temperatures on Sunday, as we're expecting highs only around 50 degrees as we get into your afternoon hours on your Sunday, with highs only in the upper 50s to near 60 in the Heber Valley. So definitely sharply cooler as we get into your Sunday compared to where we're going to be this afternoon, with temperatures approaching 80 in the Heber Valley. Now, as we go into next week, don't worry, the cool down will not last forever, but we will see temperatures below freezing again by the time we start off your Monday morning, with upper 20s to right around 30 in the area. And then as we go throughout the day on your Monday, high temperatures will climb to near 60 degrees in Park City, and highs will be back into the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Tuesday, we start off with temperatures in the 30s, but we quickly rebound with those highs on Tuesday afternoon in the mid-60s there for Park City, and highs returning back to near 70 degrees across the Heber Valley as we get into the daytime hours on your Tuesday. But another little weak disturbance will move by late Tuesday into Wednesday. That'll bring us another quick increase in cloud cover, and we'll see a slight chance of a passing shower as we get into your Wednesday. It's not going to be, again, a big deal. Probably not much in the way of measurable precipitation out of that system, but it will keep our temperatures with overnight lows right around 40 degrees as we kick off your Wednesday, with highs in the mid-60s in Park City and low to mid-70s for the Heber Valley. But then we're back on the up and up as we get towards your next Thursday, as we're looking at those lows starting off around 40 degrees, but we'll see our highs back into the upper 60s to near 70 in Park City, and we'll see those highs climbing into the mid-70s again in the Heber Valley, and that'll come with lots of sunshine. Now, keep in mind, with all this sunshine, the UV index is at 8. That's in the very high range, so sunscreen SPF 15 or greater, or you could burn in less than 20 minutes, and you don't want to do that because that's no fun.
Okay, Cedric. That is something to be avoided. Thanks, yes. And have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you, sir.
Well, let's see what these warming temperatures are doing to safety in the backcountry. On the phone, we've got Greg from the Utah Avalanche Center.
Yeah, good morning. And certainly these warm temperatures are going to have an impact today. We've had warm temperatures this past week. And the good news is it's been a slow warm up. And the snow has been able to slowly warm up, slowly adjust to the sun. But today's going to be a spike. And so we've been enjoying generally a low to moderate avalanche danger this week. And today we're going to be at moderate, and going to quickly rise to moderate because of those warm overnight temperatures. The winds today are blowing at the mid and upper elevations, and it may help cool the snowpack. But I just think the warm temperatures and the sunshine is going to rule the day. So we're expecting widespread wet avalanche activity and pretty much a consistent moderate avalanche danger all the way around the compass, all aspects. Upper elevation, northerly aspects may be spared, but pretty much everything else, we're expecting to see some wet avalanche activity today. The good news is we are going to have some cooler temperatures this weekend, so that we're likely to be returning to a low to maybe moderate avalanche danger through the weekend. But definitely for today, if you're not out there by now, you may have missed the window. And we shut down this Sunday. It'll be our last forecast of the season. And it's looking pretty quiet for the next few weeks, unfortunately. So I just want to thank KPCW and your listeners for your support, and most importantly, for your trust. It's meant a lot to me to talk to you each Friday, and look forward, have a wonderful spring, summer, and fall, and look forward to talking to you, all of you, again in November.
And there'll be a Friday in November when we get back on the phone, Greg. I look forward to it as well. Thank you,
I as
sir.
Well.
Have a
Thank
good
you,
weekend.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Phil Dean. He's the chief economist for the Kem Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. We're going to be talking about some new reports regarding Utah incomes. Then Bill Sirocco will stop by with a debrief from last night's city council meeting. Bobby Lord, the executive director of Image Reborn, will then update us on their upcoming conference for breast cancer survivors. Please stay tuned. Well, Summit County has now cleared the way for a controversial development in Kimball Junction. KPCW's Connor Thomas details the last steps before Dakota Pacific can build.
The Summit County Council adopted a temporary ordinance Wednesday allowing any developer, not just Dakota Pacific, to apply for what's called an administrative development agreement. That means Snyderville Basin developers can strike a deal that does not require a vote of the county council. Only the county manager, and it can't be overturned by voters. But the new process, which will be an option for 6 months, is really meant for one developer, Dakota Pacific Real Estate. Here's Councilmember Megan McKenna Wednesday.
If we didn't pass this ordinance today, and if an application came in and we didn't have this process available, what would happen at that point?
Then we're going to be in some form of legal jeopardy, and I don't want that to be the case.
Community Development Director Peter Barnes was referring to a new state law, Senate Bill 26, that lawmakers intended to greenlight Dakota Pacific's controversial development in Kimball Junction along Tech Center Drive. The company can now apply for a development similar to the one the county approved in December. Residents then sought to overturn it in a referendum. It's unclear if the issue will make the November ballot. Under SB 26, Dakota Pacific can apply for a development agreement that residents would not be able to overturn. The council's decision complying with SB 26 lets any developer apply for that kind of agreement too, except in Eastern Summit County. But Councilmember Chris Robinson says the county does not have to let anybody but Dakota Pacific go through with it.
The ordinance itself says that it's not obligatory on the council to accept such application. But in the case of Dakota Pacific, the state legislature has removed that discretion.
Discretion will be the key word going forward. That refers to officials' ability to tell developers yes or no. Should Dakota Pacific file its building application, County Manager Shane Scott has the discretion to deny it, only if it doesn't comply with SB 26 and pre-existing county building requirements. Residents can appeal the county manager's decision to the county council. But County Civil Attorney Dave Thomas says that would be hard for the council to overturn.
You sit in a quasi-judicial setting, not as legislators, which means your discretion is very much limited to whether or not the county manager checked the boxes correctly.
The last time legislators passed a law to let Dakota Pacific build, Summit County sued both of them. The county and developer paused their legal battle in December 2023 when Utah lawmakers asked them to reach an agreement, which they did 1 year later. Dakota Pacific now has 6 months to apply for a new agreement. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW, and I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Kem Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah recently released a series of reports regarding household income. On the phone to discuss the results, we have Chief Economist Phil Dean. Morning, Phil.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with the household income report. What did the research reveal about the level of household income here in Utah?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is that Utah, when you adjust for price, differences, cost of living between different places in the country. Utah actually had the highest household income in the nation. And you look at unadjusted data, so just comparing every state, assuming there aren't price differences, we still rank quite high, rank eighth compared to other states. So pretty interesting finding. It's just the last couple of years that when you adjust for regional cost of living differences that we actually do have the highest household income in the nation.
And those are median incomes. I want to come back to talking about, you know, the interplay between medians and averages in a minute. But first, I want to ask you, what were the main factors that contributed to this high ranking in the state of Utah?
Yeah, so there are a number of things. One, that we continue to have strong economic growth that benefits households. But certainly another driver is our unique demographics here in Utah, where we do have more household members per household. And then along with that, we have more workers per household. So think, you know, teenagers working a job. And so because of that, that pushes up the household income numbers.
And so that, so the first one is number of workers per household. What are the other? I think there was another factor that was also referenced in the report that contributed.
Yeah, so that's the main driver we highlight there in that report. I guess the other piece of it, when you're looking at that adjusted number, is our cost of living overall is lower than the rest of the U.S. And so everything except for housing were less than the nation in terms of costs on average.
So that's it's really interesting. I mean, do you have a comparative? Do you have any sort of comparative figures that sort of compares Utah and the number of workers per household to some of the other states? I mean, as you mentioned, the demographics suggest we do have more of them. Is it a substantial difference between us and some of the other states?
Yeah. So for us, we are the highest number of workers per household at 1.59 compared to 1.33 for the nation as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And 1.59, that is pretty high. How has Utah's ranking, sticking with the median for the moment, how has Utah's ranking changed over time? Have we always been at this high level?
Yeah, so we've been in the upper tier. So first of all, I'll talk about the unadjusted data. That we've kind of been in the upper third for a couple decades now, which again, sometimes surprises people because they may think of Utah as a low-wage state. And you look at the adjusted data, it's similar. We've kind of been around the top 10 or in the top 10 most years over the last several decades. But it's only over these last 2 years that we've had the highest adjusted household income in the nation.
And if we turn from sort of medians to averages, where do we have you looked at sort of average income as a measure as well?
Yeah, so that's one of the things, you know, they sound pretty similar when you think about a median or an average, but especially when you start looking at incomes, it turns out that they're pretty different. And we show that this national data is looking at median income, but we can kind of pull some of this looking at average incomes. For Utahns and basically higher income outliers can really draw that average up. And so in our other report where we look at just different income measures in different ways, that kind of highlights often averages can be 50% or more higher than what the median income is in an area.
I would imagine we would see that rather dramatically, for example, if we looked at Wyoming, where you have Teton County with these extraordinarily high incomes. I imagine that would distort the average income in Wyoming significantly.
Yeah, it definitely does. And it's one of those things I always like when I'm looking at income measures to look at the median because it's nice that, you know, Ryan Smith and I both have a nice average income, but I don't get to spend his his average income. Those high income outliers can really, I think, sometimes distort the view of what's really going on.
And then I think that's probably a good segue into the other report, which I haven't had much time to spend with. It's called How Income Measures Shape Policy. What were you trying to figure out in that report?
Yeah, so a lot of times we think about income just at a really high level. It's, you know, money coming in. But as you start digging into the economic data, it turns out there are a bunch of different ways to measure that. And the specific measure that you use can tell you very different information. In fact, as you compare some of these, you know, the U.S. Census Bureau compared to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis compared to the Federal Reserve's estimates, you can have some income measures be 60, 70, 80, 90% higher than other income measures, depending on what they're looking at. So in some ways, this is kind of for people that like to dig into economic analysis and try to understand some of these things at a deeper level, kind of in some ways a cautionary, signal to say, you know, really think about what income measure you're using and the purpose of it and its definition, because that may like either well inform or misinform the way that you're thinking about public policy.
Yeah, particularly when you're making public policy decisions, sort of, I would guess that understanding, you know, how that income measure is derived would really help you try to craft a policy that would address whatever it is you're trying to address. Talk a little bit, let's just take that a little bit of a level about how, what are some of the major differences in income measurements and what do they do to those measurements?
Yeah, so maybe I'll use two examples. So one is the census. Does surveys nationwide, and they include Utah. And in that, they use a definition that's called census money income. So it's essentially looking at cash moving back and forth, or, you know, money moving back and forth in a job or something like that. But there are a lot of things that improve people's economic well-being that aren't actually money moving back and forth. So you think about what, as economists, we call transfer payments. If that's a cash transfer payment, it is included. But if it's some other benefit, like food stamps, like a housing voucher that improves someone's economic well-being, it's not counted in many of the income definitions. So you see some of that undercounting from an economic standpoint at the low-income level. You also see it at the high-income level, where from many of these definitions, capital gains are excluded, and it turns out capital gains are a very important income source for many high-income households. The tax system does capture that capital gains income, but it's kind of this interesting comparison, depending on the measure, specific measure, and what they're trying to get at. You can have very different outcomes in terms of what total income is for Utah, or looking distributionally at different income levels. If I could just use one more example, maybe a more simple example, just thinking of that household income measure that we were thinking about. So you can look at it by household size. And if you look at that, not surprisingly, a single person in a household compared to a larger household of five or six people or whatever tends to have less income. So you might say, oh, they're worse off economically. But then when you look at it on a per household member basis, it turns out single people have among some of the highest incomes on a per household member basis. And so it's depending on which lens you're looking at, you might have very different takeaways. And especially from a public policy standpoint, you might say, someone's low income, someone's high income, when there's actually quite a bit of nuance to that.
And I suppose one of the interesting places where this comes into most stark view is when you're talking about income inequality. Because I think if you don't account for transfers in the income measure, you're going to get a very different picture than if you do. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah, and we talk about that some in our report, have a graph there from the Congressional Budget Office that kind of highlights that issue. So, you know, there is a lot of discussion about increasing income inequality over time. But as you start digging into different ways of measuring that and thinking about it, it turns out many common measures exclude a lot of the transfers. So you think about taxes coming out at the federal level, especially from higher income households, and going to lower income households through different sources of transfer payments. And so if you're excluding the kind of taking and giving aspect of that, you get a very different picture than when you're including that about the level of inequality.
Yeah. Okay, before we go, the good news for Utah is not just restricted incomes. Let's talk about economic growth for just a minute. We had some pretty significant real GDP growth in 2024, didn't we?
Yeah, so it grew, and when we say, as economists, we say real GDP, that means inflation-adjusted GDP growth, was 4.5%. in Utah in 2024, and it turns out that led the nation. We were often near the top, but not always necessarily at the top, and we were in 2024, which I found quite interesting because our job growth slowed. Mm-hmm. We've been, we're still growing, but it's definitely moderated over the last several years. But our GDP growth continues to be quite strong. And GDP is actually a measure of income, although it's most people don't think of it that way. It's income from production out there in the economy. We actually surpassed $300 billion for the first time as a state in 2024. And just one other point on that we not only have, had the highest growth rate last year, but you look back over the past decade, we have the fastest growing GDP in the nation over the last decade when measured by growth rate.
And just to compare, to give us a source of comparison for that 4.5%, what was, do you have off the top of your head the national GDP for 2024?
I should know this, the exact number. I don't offhand, but I think
wait a minute.
It was,
here in the chart. 2.8
is my recollection.
I see it on. I urge people to pull this fact sheet that you guys 2.8. Have put out. You guys have put out this fact sheet, Economic Growth Utah 2024, and because there's a remarkable. I sound really nerdy now. There is a remarkable figure as in the upper left-hand corner that shows all the different states, and you look at Utah's 4.5%, and it just stands out as so much higher than many of those other states, which kind of makes sense if you think we were at 4.5 and the nation as a whole was at 2.8.
Yeah, and with that, there was only one other state that was even above 4, South Carolina. So only two states had above 4% growth. And again, this is something that jumped out at me because some of the job growth numbers are slowing, but you're seeing this still pretty strong GDP growth and definitely stronger than the nation.
Okay, well, let's hope we have a similar conversation a year from now. I've been speaking with Chief Economist Phil Dean of the Kem Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah about some recent studies that they've come out with, which are very interesting. Phil, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Here in the studio to talk about it is Councilmember Bill Scirocco.
Good morning, Roger.
Morning, Bill. Thanks for being here. Okay, let's start with what I know is one of your favorite issues, transportation and Route 248. I know you guys spent some time yesterday talking about parking rides.
Unfortunately, this is radio, so you can't see the big smile on my face. But thank you. Thank you for starting with that topic, Roger. We had a staff communication on our park and ride study to follow up on some earlier work that the staff had done. Council gave the staff direction to continue pursuing basically two options. One is called the Gordo Lot. That's a parcel of land the city owns on 248, about a mile, in towards town near Richardson Flat Road. And the other was for the staff to continue studying the continued use of our lot out in Richardson Flat, which we started service out there 3 or 4 years ago. And it's taken off pretty dramatically as we've increased bus service out there. We've seen usage increase pretty handily.
Now, there was a third option on the table, where was the third option?
It was a former site that is sandwiched between Old Highway 40 and the on-ramp for Highway 40. That area is complicated now. They realigned Old Highway 40. And now there's some surplus UDOT land adjacent where folks may have seen in the news a week or two ago that UDOT is talking about, DABS is talking about putting a liquor store in that location. And there is a Maverick also going in across the street from that. So that's going to be that intersection is going to be very cluttered. So we're going to avoid that location, I think, for now. But we still have some things we need to figure out. We still need to have some conversations with UDOT and DABS.
Well, this is a pretty important issue because obviously the 248 corridor and the congestion is an ongoing problem. And I know this is one that you're particularly interested in. Let's talk about some of the advantages and disadvantages that you heard from each of these locations.
Yeah, so for me, Roger, what my goal is, I view Highway 40 in some senses as a moat on our eastern border to Park City. And I think if we're going to do anything, we should keep it outside the moat. So right now, currently, Richardson Flat is just outside that moat. It's just east of Highway 40. So I really love the potential there. We can possibly in the future have direct access off of Highway 40 directly into a park and ride lot there, and that's really the gold standard. Gordo is a piece of property a mile west of Highway 40 that the city owns. We just spent some money to clean up the contaminated soils there, but it borders Round Valley. It's at that Richardson Flat Road intersection. And I just feel, you know, I don't want to bring that traffic in towards town at all. I don't want to bring those cars in towards town. So for me, I'd like to keep it on the other side of the moat. And, you know, I'd be leaning towards the Richardson Flat solution, but staff is going to do the work and council is going to make the best decision for the city.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about Richardson Flat. One of the things that Richardson Flat, I think, is most significant is that it has proved that we can make a park and ride work. I think, you know, 3 years ago, I would drive by and it was this abandoned, you know, thing. It was like the lights were on. It was plowed. There were no cars there. And I think that the experiment of enhancing the bus service has proven to be a pretty significant success.
It has, Roger. Don't quote me exactly, but if my recollection is correct, I think the increase in service from the 22-23 ski season to the 23-24 ski season was up 25%. Not service, I mean usage, was up 25%. And that was simply by making the buses go express to the base of Park City Mountain. And also express to Deer Valley. You know, as we've increased service there, the public has responded pretty dramatically. And we've seen the bulk of that usage, actually. Cell phone data tells us that it's Salt Lake County visitors that are using that. So they're bypassing Kimmel Junction, and they're coming around, and they're parking at Richardson Flat. So that's pretty encouraging.
And what are we seeing? Is there any usage that's being gone outside the ski season that's of any significant degree?
Yeah, when we have special events in town. So, for instance, you know, Mountain Town Music was in the council a couple weeks ago. They want to bring that music festival back into Park City, which I think is a great idea. You know, we just need to make sure that we nail the mitigations, and one of those is making sure that they have enough parking. So that an event like that is exactly how it would be used now in the summer season, if you will.
Okay, now, to me, the lesson from the improvement at Richardson Flat was if you make the right amenity and the right set of attractions. If you do that, they will come. Not if you build it, but if you do that. So the first one was obviously buses, more frequent buses. First of all, is there room around the existing area to do a little bit of what I would call magnet development for a park and ride?
You know, my answer to that would be yes. It's a little bit complicated, but no more complicated than just about any other area in town. You put a shovel in the ground, and, you know, we have issues with mining soils. There is a portion of that property that contains, you know, mine tailings, right? There is work going on at the EPA level to figure out what the plan forward is for that, how to remediate that, how to cap that and mitigate that. And, you know, what I would say is, we built a parking lot already out there. So if we could do it once, I think we could do it again.
Is the land available? I mean, yeah. I know. Okay, it's leased right now.
So the city has a 30-acre leasehold out there.
Okay.
Right now, we have parking spots for just over 700 cars. That's roughly probably about 7 to 8 acres of property that we're using for that. So we have, you know, potentially another 22, 23 acres to work with.
And what is there discussion about sort of doing some more improvements to create, you know, that kind of a what I would call a magnet stop?
Yeah, so I think there's maybe there's two paths right now. So Deer Valley is trying to solve for their parking mitigation for when they begin construction. So it'll be interesting to see where Deer Valley falls on that solution. You know, I think Richardson Flat could be a great spot for us to do that temporary parking mitigation for them. And then there's the longer term process of us finding the spot for the best park and ride solution. And, you know, perhaps that's Richardson Flat. I mean, there's plenty of room out there. It's in a good location. If we got access off of Highway 40, to me, that would be, you know, that would be pretty compelling.
Okay, so Gordo is obviously another major consideration. Yep. It has some advantages as well.
Yep.
How big is the Gordo option?
So I believe we have 17 acres at Gordo. Some of that we cannot use. Most of it we can. You know, my concerns with the Gordo location is we're having those people get off of Highway 40 and head towards town. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you just think at the end of the day, if we park 1,000 cars there, they have to get out and make a left across 248. So I think that's going to create considerable traffic in that 248 corridor. I'm trying to push that traffic just on the other side. It's only a mile. It's probably about a mile over to Richardson Flat Park and Ride from that traffic light on 248 where Gordo is. So that's maybe 2-3 minutes.
So if we get into the big picture dreams element, and obviously this is, you know, a specific, current, concrete question that's in front of you, but you want it to fit into sort of potential big picture things. We talked about, I know you've talked about different alternative transportation modes. Mm-hmm. Would the Richardson Flat lot lend itself to, for example, some kind of gondola solution, and some kind of other big picture solutions?
Yeah, look, I think because of that location, like all of those things could be on the table. You know, we currently run buses there, so we know we can run buses. There is an existing Union Pacific Rail right of way which crosses through that property. That's 100 feet wide and comes all the way into Bonanza Drive. And then because it's, you know, it's hard to notice because you don't, when you drive up 40 and you look to the west, you don't really realize how close you are to Deer Valley. But just on the other side of those hills is Snow Park. So, you know, maybe in the future there's a potential to get just over those hills from Richardson Flat and drop people in Snow Park with some sort of aerial gondola type solution. You know, there are many options, and that's what I like. I like the optionality about it.
That's what Richardson Flat, it sounds like it does. It really does leave open the potential for future decisions.
Yeah, and you know, it leaves us the opportunity to do something that's transformational. It gives us the ability to perhaps in the future put in some sort of transportation system that allows us to, you know, to force a change of behavior, which is actually in the better interest of the people that live here and the people that are visiting.
Okay. Anything else on remote parking other than my urging the city to continue to consider putting a daycare center at any park and ride because that will certainly facilitate people parking there.
Yeah, no, the way we envision it is that when we do have a park and ride, there should be some services around it that make it more compelling. So that certainly would be in the in part of our calculations.
Okay. Anything else on park and rides?
No, we're doing the park and ride study that's kind of in tandem with our Recreate 248 corridor study. Timing for that is looking, you know, like the end of this year for us to get the Recreate 248 work back. But you know, council's always looking for a chance to accelerate that. So we're doing the best we can.
Brief conversation about the budget yesterday.
Yeah.
Anything significant there?
Nothing significant. I think any person who doesn't sleep through the day can see that there's a little bit of economic uncertainty that's arisen over the past few weeks. You know, so that gives me a little bit of pause. Our city manager's done a great job, of measuring KPIs, making sure we're delivering the services we intend to deliver, and also looking for efficiencies in how we operate so that we can streamline and keep costs lower.
Along those lines, I think there was some concern expressed in the sales tax report about potential weakening consumer sentiment.
Yeah, look, I didn't look, thank God, before I came in this morning what the stock market was doing.
But it's pretty flat.
The S&P 500 is down somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% over the last month. That's, you know, borderline bear market territory. I think that has some impact on the consumer sentiment. You know, how that plays out here in Park City, that's TBD. But I think it's smart to look forward with a cautious eye and make sure that we tighten our belt a little bit.
Okay. Talked about the leadership program, which I think is an important program.
Yes.
Do you believe it's important the city continue to fund it?
I do. And there really was no conversation about whether the city would or would not continue funding it. It was, what that pie looks like. So there was a little conversation about, you know, what the makeup of the program is, where the folks that are in the program are coming from, where they work. And we're just trying to make sure that we represent all of the taxpayers of Park City. And, they have an investment in that leadership program through our city government. And we just want to make sure that they're getting an appropriate return for that investment.
And I think there was some discussion about looking toward other sources of funding outside just the city.
Yeah, look, there's, we have a new leader, Scott Van Hartsveld, for Leadership Park City. Scott has done a great job of collecting feedback from former class members. And, he's charted a course forward which may entail some additional needs for he really wants to lean into real leadership like training. Like there's a plethora of academic sources, professional sources that are experts on leadership training, and that was the one area where we felt we needed to step up. And we told Scott, look, figure out what you need and come back and tell us, and then we'll help you figure out how it'll get paid for.
Okay. And I think that the notion is, I think there was some discussion of looking for other sources outside the city as well.
Yeah, there are four or five direct cash contributors. The Chamber's one of them. Deer Valley was one of them. Summit County's one of them. So as we look at the roster of the class, and, you know, if two-thirds of the class is from inside the city boundary, but outside in the unincorporated area, you know, we may want to have a conversation with the county council and see if they could step up a little bit.
There was a brief discussion of the Yarrow project, which some people will always call the Yarrow, but of the DoubleTree project. Where does that stand, and does the new legislation sort of create a different path for them to try to get an approval?
So, yeah, I still refer to it as the Yarrow, Roger.
It's right by the Albertsons.
Yeah, exactly. I stayed there in 2000, and I remember looking out the window at the Domino's across the street. It's etched in my mind. But, yeah, so we did talk about that. We have this process with the Bonanza Small Area Plan, and we're working towards land management code changes. Unfortunately, that process hasn't happened fast enough to match up with the timeline for the Yarrow, for the redevelopment there. There are a number of economic factors that are involved. So council will look for any opportunity to advance the council goals. And one of our council goals is to make sure that Bonanza Park area gets redeveloped and provides a number of benefits for people that live here.
Any news on, I know the RFPs were submitted. Are we still in a quiet zone to hear what's happening on the results of that?
I think we're in the scoring process right now.
Yeah.
And I think that'll be wrapped soon. And I think the council's expecting to hear something by the end of the month, first week in May, on what that scoring looked like. And then the council will do a round of interviews with the top two finalists. And then we'll move forward.
Okay. Bill, you've consistently expressed an ambition to do big things. Rumor has it that there's an open mayor's race this year. And I'm going to ask you point blank, are you thinking about it, or are you ready to declare and make some news here on the Local News Hour?
Yeah, no, I'd love to make news. Unfortunately, that's not the news I'm going to make, Roger. I honestly haven't thought about it. You know, I really, I've talked about big ideas. I've talked about transformation. I've talked about the future a lot. We're working as hard as we can on that. I'm really focused on that. I think being on the council, you know, gives me a great avenue to affect change that way. So I'm happy where I am, and I'm just looking to do the best job I can.
A classic politician's answer. I don't think he shut the door. Bill, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome, Roger.
Image Reborn Foundation's mission is to provide no-cost renewal retreats to those diagnosed with breast cancer and to support them in living rich and fulfilling lives. Here to talk about the foundation and an upcoming conference here in Park City is Executive Director Bobby Lord. Morning, Bobby, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Bobby, can you share just a bit more about what the mission of the foundation is?
Yes, definitely. We have been around for over 25 years, and our mission is to provide those who have been diagnosed with breast cancer something after their treatment. And so we kind of, a lot of times the doctors focus just on their physical health, getting them well, getting them to survive. And then afterwards, they are still feeling like something is missing, that they're not the same. So these retreats really focus on that, to give them a weekend, a free weekend, where they can heal, they can grieve, and they can connect with others who have been through a similar experience.
So talk a little bit more about the kinds of programs that you put on every year.
So we do our retreats. Those are kind of our flagship program. This year, we are doing 34, I believe, across America. Most are here in Utah in the Park City area. Our founder, Dr. Salt, is from the Park City, and we love the healing nature of the mountains. So those are our biggest ones. We have branched into Colorado, Texas, and Florida, and just barely we did our first one in Puerto Rico. And like I said, that's about healing. We have an amazing Park City chef, Chef Otto, that comes in and provides gourmet meals. We have yoga. We have massage therapists. We have medical providers that come in to do a question and answer. So like I said, that weekend is all about that. In addition, we do have an alumni program to kind of have some things to help kind of hold their hand after their initial retreat. And this weekend, we have our third annual breast cancer conference. that's all about intimacy and self-love and your body image. We started that 3 years ago because after our retreats, we asked participants if there was anything we're missing. And we constantly get told about that intimacy issue, how their body, so much of what made them, you know, female or, you know, kind of have that intimate part with them, with their partners, or that was missing. It changed. It was different. And so that was really where doctors were clueless when they asked questions. They didn't know how to help. And so we have this conference. It's a one-day conference that brings together experts to really dive into those, ask where you can ask questions. And it's all centered on that.
And that program here is, one of those programs is here in Park City tomorrow.
Yes, yeah, that conference is here in Park City tomorrow. Thanks with an amazing partnership with Intermountain Health. We will be at the Park City Hospital, the Blair Education Center, from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. And there's breakfast, there's lunch, and then, like I mentioned, there's all these amazing providers. And last year and this year, we've actually invited partners to come as well, so they can participate with their wives or their spouses.
And before I just want to make sure, is registration still open, and how would someone register to attend?
Yes, registration is still open. We do still have seats available, and they can just go to our website, imagereborn.org, Breast Cancer Conference. And it is most, it's about $10 for a couple, but if that's prohibitive, then they can email us and we will give them a coupon code. So we want to make sure this is available to everybody, and they can email at info@imagereborn.org.
Now, the term image is in your name, and it obviously is a critical part of this. Can you talk a little bit more about what kind of counseling, what kind of lessons can be taught with respect to body image?
Yes, definitely. Like I mentioned, after, especially with breast cancer, often things are very different. Many have gone through a mastectomy, also with hormone changes and medications. Like I said, they feel very much different. And our goal is to help them kind of embrace this new them. And like I mentioned, we have kind of like somebody that's going to come in and talk about like the body image, and talk about, we have somebody that'll do like kind of a movement thing to help us calm down and to heal. We have sex therapists, and then we're also doing a support group. So, like I mentioned, we have a lot of different people, but again, it's to help you connect with your body and to kind of rebuild that self-compassion and that self-love with yourself and who you are now.
And what tools have you found in the past to be most effective in this regard, in terms of sort of helping survivors adjust to their new bodies?
One big thing, and we do this at retreats and other times throughout the year, is a grief circle. It's a moment where we have a therapist or a specialist that comes in and just helps these women or helps these attendees focus on what they did lose. Like, let them just grieve it for a minute. And then we switch at the end of that and do something more with gratitude to help them, you know, realize that this new body is amazing, that their body saved them as well as tried to harm them. And then the other thing I think that's really big is just that connection with others who also went through that.
Now, Bobby, you put on, you know, obviously a number of these weekends, $10 somehow, I don't think, probably gets your cost back. How do you guys raise money to carry on this work?
We have amazing partners, especially in the Park City area. We often have Park City donors that will donate their homes for the weekend so that we have a place to stay. But a lot of it is we have local supporters. So, for example, this breast cancer conference is being, the venues being covered by Intermountain Health, as well as all of the food. We apply for grants. We have a huge gala every single year there in Park City at the Stein Erickson, which this year will be on October 18th. So we love our supporters. So it is, like I said, the retreats are 100% free. This conference can be free if needed. And again, we want anybody who needs this to have it, because they all deserve it.
We've been speaking with Bobby Lord, the executive director of Image Reborn. Anything else you want to let our listeners know before we go?
No, just thank you so much for inviting us to be on here. We've done it a couple times, and we love talking with you. And it's not too late. If people want to come to our conference, please, please join us.
I want to remind our listeners that there will be pile burning on Treasure Hill today and also tomorrow from Alpine Forestry. If you see smoke coming from up there, it's not a problem. There is no need to report it. The Park City School District now has the go-ahead to build a new sports campus on the site of Treasure Mountain Junior High. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports some neighbors are upset about the handling of the project.
On Wednesday, the Park City Planning Commission voted 3-1 to approve a permit for the district to build a new sports complex on the junior high site, along with other additions to Dozier Field. Treasure Mountain is scheduled to be demolished later this year. In its place will be a baseball field, a softball field, two soccer fields, and 8 tennis courts, along with support facilities and nearly 100 parking spaces. The project plans also include a new 13,000 square foot building on the north end of Dozier Field and another gateway building at its entrance. Other improvements include expanding the bleachers and resurfacing the track around the field. Commissioner Laura Susser voted against the permit. She criticized the location of the tennis courts on the northern section of the Treasure Mountain property, which is closer to homes in Park Meadows. The permit does not allow pickleball due to noise concerns, but Susser questioned if the school district will request to allow pickleball in the future.
Because if pickleball is ever allowed on these courts, it would be very disruptive, I think, to the sanctuary there in the back.
Gina Rossi was one of several residents of Lucky John Drive, which runs along the north end of the school district campus, to speak out against the project.
What is being built is damaging our property values. It is decreasing quality of life, and it does not need to be that way.
The residents criticized the school district's lack of communication about the project and said they haven't returned any requests to provide feedback on the proposal. A contingent also showed up at the school board meeting Tuesday to express their discontent. Some blame was put on former school district chief operating officer Mike Tanner, who led construction projects before his position was eliminated by the district last week. School district spokesperson Colton Elliott told KPCW the project has been a standing item at monthly board meetings since August 2024, which include opportunities for public comment. Commissioner John Frontero sympathized with the neighbors' concerns and expressed some hesitancy about moving forward.
I would be concerned if we went through and voted on this, only to find out at a later date that perhaps the school district or Mr. Tanner perhaps did not notify the public properly.
But City Attorney Mark Harrington said that's not the Planning Commission's role.
We have to distinguish between school district notice and our notice. And the only thing that's properly before you is the city notice. And there is nothing but confirmation that that was properly noticed. And it's simply not within this board's power to delay action based on what a different jurisdiction did or didn't do.
The permit approved Wednesday also includes conditions that all lights at the sports complex must be dark sky compliant and turned off no later than 11 p.m. Park City School Board member Nick Reed said on KPCW's Local News Hour Thursday, the district hopes to install the baseball and softball fields this year. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
With trails opening for the summer season, Wasatch County leaders say they want coordinated rules for e-bike users. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports what this means for riders this summer.
Midway became the first government in the Heber Valley to adopt formal e-bike rules when it added an ordinance in November. Unlike in neighboring Summit County, where there's an across-the-board speed limit of 15 miles per hour, Midway opted not to set a speed limit. Instead, the town lets police use their best judgment about reckless or hazardous riding. At an interlocal meeting of Wasatch County governments Wednesday night, Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson encouraged other local leaders to build on what her town started to create similar e-bike guidelines for the whole region.
I think uniformity is pretty critical. As we've talked to the officers that are patrolling now in Midway, we've gotten their input, and they're just saying if they know that the law doesn't say everywhere, it's going to be a piece of cake for them, right?
Johnson said enforcement could mean speeding tickets or, for younger riders, confiscating the bike. Scott House is a Heber resident and a member of the Wasatch Trails Foundation board. He said enforcement will help curb reckless riders pretty quickly.
Speaking from experience, once a 14-year-old pushes a dirt bike home with a sheriff following him with their lights on, them and all their friends will no longer participate in that activity.
He said community gatherings this summer are a good opportunity to educate about e-bike etiquette.
It just takes time for people to gather that information and digest it. And the more that we put it in front of them, concerts at the park, any events we're doing in Midway, Swiss Days, those are great opportunities just to have that information available for the public. And the more people that see it, the more it gets picked up by the community.
House said with time, trail users self-enforce rules, for example, reminding other bikers to slow down for pedestrians or yield to horses. Leaders said they will create handouts about e-bike rules for local bike shops and community events. In the meantime, Heber City could soon follow Midway's lead and adopt an e-bike ordinance. It's scheduled for discussion on April 15th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. We've got a great show coming up Monday on Mountain Money with Professor Elena Patel of the Utah Business School.